Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, meditation instructor Eric Weinberg gives the first in a series of talks meant to introduce the lineage holders of the Karmakaju. We'll be mainly relying on the books History of the Karmapas by Lama Kunsang, Lama Pemo, and Marie Ubel, and include information from the newly released The Karmapas and Their Mahamudra Forefathers. Talks on these short biographies will be interspersed with talks based on Ultimately Perfect, His Eminence Taisi Tu Rinpoche's excellent exposition of the view of Mahamudra. All of these books are available through Namse Bangzo Bookstore and at the Columbus KTC Book Table. This first talk is an introduction to the Indian masters Tilopa and Naropa. Enjoy the podcast.
We are about to embark on a new voyage. I saw that Lama Kathy titled this, Who is the Karmapa? That's sort of what's going to happen over the next few months, but not exactly what today is meant to be, although it ties in. We completed a book recently, and we were thinking about what we would like to do next, and we're going to try something new. So it could be, who knows, it could be a colossal failure. I hope not. So everybody pray for the Buddha's blessings throughout this whole process, because we'll need that. I have a particular fondness for stories. I have a particular fondness for actually understanding the people who are in our lineage, which is why Lama Kathy titled it, Who is the Karmapa? Because understanding their path helps me understand my own a little bit. It helps me deepen my affection for my own path and also appreciation for those that have gone before, because actually this isn't an easy path. Nobody ever comes to Buddhism because everything's hunky-dory. There are all kinds of reasons for that, but for one thing, even basic meditation, if you take it as a path, in other words, you do some every day, that's actually not easy in this society or in any other, let alone the people who undertake the letting go of everything in order to go into retreat and take teachings and have direct realization themselves. And all that just in order to take somebody like me or somebody like you and give us the tools we need to reduce our suffering. See, that's why we come. We're not feeling great about something, and we try everything, and everything doesn't work, and we wind up being here. I had somebody tell me on Thursday, it was really interesting. He was at my house. He saw where I meditate. There are some tonkas around and things like that. And he said, so is this like, are you Buddhist? And I said, yeah. And he said, so is this like Dalai Lama? And I said, yeah, it's like that. And he said, what I've read, he's in 12-step program. And he said, what I read is, it seems like a lot of this and a lot of that agree. So I kind of like it. He says, I have a cousin who's an atheist and he's read everything. And he said, Buddhism's the only thing that makes sense to him. The point is we encounter these teachings and they're about method of working with our own minds rather than about belief. However, it's not just a cookbook. It's not just a tool belt, which is the way I regard it most of the time for myself. It's people. And like Bab said, people who need people are the luckiest people in the world. And we need these we need these people. And so I wanted to talk about them, and we picked out this book, which I think we'll have some of on the book table eventually. It's called History of the Karmapas. Really, really good book. Great stories, well told. And then there's one that was just published, The Karmapas and Their Mahamudra Forefathers. And the way I see this going is we'll probably use this book for the, you know, framework for the talks, but there'll be some information, additional information that comes from this one as well. And then, this is so crazy, we're doing like all this at once. There's this book by His Eminence Thaisithu, Ultimately Perfect, which is really the view that all these teachers taught. This is the view of Buddha nature. And that's really where the whole Mahamudra tradition, that's kind of the seed for the great forest of teachers that have arisen in this tradition. Comes from this teaching on Buddha nature. So what we're planning on doing, because it can get old if you just hear little book reports or biographies every week for, you know, that Lama Kathy's not here, we decided to go alternate weeks, do a little biography 1 week, and then a little bit of the view of the people that we're doing the biographies of in the following week, and so on and forth, so forth, so that we kind of can put a face to the teaching, and hopefully so that our own feeling of connection to these teachings can grow more and more. Because honestly, it's that feeling of connection to the teachings that's going to bring you to the cushion. And that's the whole object of the exercise, is that you get involved in your own practice. That'll get referred to in these first two biographies. The way we see this lineage is it really did all start with Shakyamuni. But we're not going all the way back there, because there's a particular approach and a particular set of teachings that began 1,200 years ago or so with a fellow that we call Talopa. And his guru, which was actually the primordial Buddha himself. Talopa had such a drive that he was able to encounter the primordial Buddha himself and various emanations of the primordial Buddha and get these teachings. And we start with Talopa, and then his main student, who was Naropa. You might have heard of him before. There's a university in Colorado named after Naropa. And those are what we call the Indian forefathers. To be fair, I wrote Lama Kathy when we were first putting this together. I said foremothers and fathers, because I don't like leaving the women out. These old traditions tend to do that. It turns out that at least one of Talopa's human teachers was a woman named Sukhasiddhi, and she gave him practices that are now part of the six yogas of Naropa that people who go into three-year retreat do. Also, one of the main teachers of Naropa, besides Talopa, was a woman named Niguma, who was actually the lineage founder of a whole branch of the Kagyu, the Shangpa Kagyu, which continues to this day, and the head of that lineage is Kalu Rinpoche, the second Kalu Rinpoche. And so I don't want this, I particularly want to emphasize that even though these are old texts and an old tradition of history that is kind of male-centric, the stories of the women that contributed actually are part of the thing too. And it's even though it's not traditional to present it this way, I have declined to leave them out. So women figure big in all of this. And I'll try as we go along to highlight some of that, not because of some kind of teaching affirmative action or something like that, although I have nothing against that, but just because it'll make more sense. It just does make more sense. As I told Lama Kathy in my email back to her, I said, because... She said, what do you mean? And I said, well, because there's Suka City and Naguma, and there's about 3.52 billion good reasons not to leave them out. She thought that was funny. That's roughly how many women are in the world today. So here we go. But before we begin, let's start with our three-line refuge prayer. If you know the Tibetan, please chant it along with me. If you don't, please follow along in your heart, thinking that we are taking refuge. We are here because we want some insight into this thing called life, whether it's great or not so great today. In order to get the goodness out of it, whatever it is. And the goodness is our own Buddha nature, so we take refuge in the Buddha. And we take refuge in the teachings of the historical Buddha, which help us to cleanse the doors of perception to the point where we can see this ultimately perfect nature. And we take refuge in the Sangha, which includes all those who have gone before us, the teachers, and all those that we travel the path with, both visible and invisible, including everybody in this room right now. Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Chang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Daki Jin So Gi Pe Sunam Ki Drola Penshir Sanje Rupar Sho Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Changchu Pardu Dagni Gyapsu Chi Dagi Jinso Gipe Sunam Ki Rola Pinchir Sanje Rupar Sho Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Changchu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Gipe Sunam Ki Drola Penshir Sanje Rupar Sho. Thank you. Ah, Talopa. Talopa wasn't his name originally. That wasn't his given name. Somewhere in the literature I have that. I've forgotten it. Talopa means that he's a beater of sesame seeds. Til are sesame seeds. Opa. Op is pound. And pa is, you know, the one who. So, Talopa. One who pounds sesame seeds. That's actually a punchline for later on. So, some of these stories have some very familiar rings to them, like the history of the Buddha. Makes me wonder. He also was born kind of a high-born Brahmin. And his dad was also like in charge of the principality where he was. And so he was an entitled guy. And he somehow, you know, it's weird. You can go two ways with that when you're an entitled guy. You can, once you realize that you've got it good, you can spend your life defending it and protecting it and doing good or ill, but basically clinging to that identity. Or you can realize at some point, as he did and as Shakyamuni did, I've got it all, but I'm not satisfied. And he did. He kind of was that guy. I think we're all that guy to this, to a certain extent. That's why we're here in this room. And so he decided, even though he was a Brahmin in the Hindu tradition, he decided he wanted to seek instruction, teaching in the Dharma, because he was pretty well educated, and he knew that the Dharma wasn't about the deities of the Hindu pantheon. It was about working on yourself, and he felt like he needed to work on himself. And he'd heard about, there were these guys running around India at that time called the Mahasiddhas. If you ever have a chance to read some about some people, you want to read about some really wild people, you ought to read about the Mahasiddhas. One of them, notably, was a guy named Nagarjuna, who was famous then and is still famous today. A lot of what is taught in Mahayana Buddhism to this day comes relatively directly from Nagarjuna. So he went in search of Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna, being at that point aware, believe it or not, our teachers are aware of us. The authentic ones are. I remember the first time I saw the 17th Karmapa. He, with overwhelming tenderness, looked at all of us. There were probably in that 250, 300 people in that room. A small gathering of friends. And he said, at night I look at the moon and pray. And he said, if you look at the moon and remember me, I will see you and I will pray for you. I've come to believe, for a whole bunch of reasons, that that's true. So Talopa had that kind of relationship with Nagarjuna even before he had met Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna kind of saw him coming. And the story goes that Nagarjuna was kind of a big dude. He was tall and he was heavy. And Talopa was kind of a little dude. And Nagarjuna placed himself in the middle of a river that he knew Talopa would be coming to, kind of as if he were stuck trying to get across. And Talopa saw him, didn't know who he was, and said, hey, what's going on? he says, "I'm stuck. Can I help you?" "Yeah, I hope so." And Talopa said, "I'll get you across the other side." And the Garjuna said, "You're a little guy and I'm a big guy. I don't think this will work." And Talopa said, "I'm going to do it." And he did. It wasn't that Nagarjuna needed Talopa to prove anything to him. But he gave Talopa the opportunity to prove something to himself about perseverance and diligence and, you know, with really applying himself and creativity and all of that, he could overcome obstacles, because he could also see that Talopa had some heavy karma and was going to have to be worked through. There were going to be some obstacles. There were going to be some hardships. And sure enough, there were. So Nagarjuna did take him as a student, and he did tell him he'd have to go into a retreat for a while. And he went into a retreat for a while, and he made some progress. And a woman came to his retreat cave and said, "You really need it back home." There was a big problem. Neighboring kingdom was going to invade and all that. And his dad was old and sick, or even maybe passed away already. So he decided, out of a sense of compassion, he'd leave his cave and go back to where he came from. And without bloodshed, he was able to actually settle everything down, reestablish some kind of peaceful order. This is like historical part. And then he returned to the cave where the Dakinis came to teach him. Now, you hear about the Dakinis and these things, they would be like angels, particularly female angels. And they're often emissaries of Buddhas that come and teach, students, particularly ones whose perceptions are so clean that they can see them. My suspicion is we've all got angels around us all the time. And all of them, we each probably have our own. This is from Talmud. There's a thing where a great rabbi said, every person, every blade of grass has its own angel, always with them, simply saying, "Grow, grow, grow." Well, I think that's true. And I think if you get to a certain level, you can actually see it. And anyway, Talopa was at that level, and he received teachings from Dakinis who were sent by the Buddha, Vajradhara, the primordial Buddha himself. Vajradhara, just so you know, is the guy that's in the center of our refuge tree. And if you wanted to understand that in the context of Shakyamuni, it's like we see Shakyamuni as a human being because of the limitations of our perception. But there's another whole level of his existence. So that human emanation is what we would call Nirmanakaya. Lama Kathy gave a talk about Nirmanakaya a couple weeks ago. Then there's this next level that is like pure contact with all the essential and elemental energies of the universe. So they look more like, say, Chenrezig looks, you know, if you can see them, if you can see beyond the coarse exterior. And Vajradhara is like the Sambhogakaya, or the inner manifestation of Shakyamuni. And then the Dharmakaya is something that is beyond words. That's realizing the Dharmakaya is realizing things as they are, which we're taught is limitless and infinite. And therefore, there aren't words for it, because words are limits. Words are boundaries. their descriptions and so on. So it's one of those things that you just got to be there. And that's actually where we're all trying to get to. It's where Tilopa was trying to get to. So Vajradhara sends these angels to teach him. And he actually is in retreat in a cave for 12 years. And after 12 years, they say he was chained to the cave, so because he knew he'd be tempted to leave. He was a rich boy, and he wanted a corned beef sandwich, you know what I'm saying? He wasn't really willing to let go of this until he was. So he chained himself into the cave, and he practiced the teachings. So at the end of 12 years, he wanted to leave. He wanted to come back. He felt like he had had the realization that he could have. The Dakinis basically thought it wasn't a good idea. And he then said, I will demonstrate to you that it's a good idea. And he got a small animal. And using one of the things that he had been taught, that we now call POA, it's transference of consciousness. It's a meditation done at the time of death to help somebody's consciousness or your own go directly to the pure realm of a Buddha. So he's there and these angels are there and he takes this little bird and he snaps his fingers and transfers the consciousness of the bird to the pure realms. And they looked and they said, oh, you're ready. You can go now. So so he did that, but he wasn't done yet. There were still some more trials and tribulations along the way. He had another Dakini named Matonka who came to give him teachings. And because Nagarjuna wasn't available at the time, Nagarjuna sent her. She saw that he still possessed this strong pride that just comes with being born into an entitled kind of lifestyle. And she said, you need to go live with a prostitute and pound sesame seeds. In other words, this is about as low as you can get. So during the day, this prostitute would pound sesame seeds to get oil. And then all night, Tilopa would kind of pimp for her, bring her customers and so on and so forth. The story goes that she was also interested in the Dharma, and she accepted Tilopa because of his, even though he was doing that, she knew there was more there. And people basically looked down on him because he had become the lowest of the low. And he kept practicing and he realized something about he was feeling better and better, even though in terms of the culture, he was being treated worse and worse. And he realized that there was something inherent in him beyond what the projections were, beyond what his projections were in the culture. And one day, while he was pounding sesame seeds, just like he sat down to pound sesame seeds one minute, and he got up and he got it. Somehow it broke through. The story in the book says that he levitated to the height of 7 royal palm trees. Royal palms are pretty tall. And he was floating in the sky. And this woman, this prostitute that he was working with, saw him and said, wow, I wanted that too. I want to be where you are. And the story is that he dropped a flower and it bonked her on the head. And there was some kind of instant transmission and she floated up there too. And all the people from the town started coming. And Tilopa blessed them, and they had realization. Now, you've got to understand realization and enlightenment, two different things, but they had realization of the nature of their mind. Realization of the nature of your mind is like the first step. That's your entry to the first level of bodhisattvahood. They call them bhumis. So anyway, they all got it, seeing this sesame grinder floating in the air. And the story goes that everybody disappeared for a moment. And then, of course, reappeared. But he became famous for that and began to teach at that point. And his most famous teachings are in literature that we use to this day. So teaching meditation this morning, the story about how one proceeds from being like a mountain stream to flowing down to becoming a big river and ultimately becoming like the ocean. That's from his Mahamudra transmission. Also, there's this thing that we call the 6 points of Naropa that is often shared. I had it here. I must have grabbed the wrong thing. Let's see if I can remember them. Don't invite the future. In other words, don't hang on to your plans and your dreams. This is instructions for meditation now. Of course, it's valuable to plan a lot of things a lot of times. When you're meditating, don't get lost in thoughts about the future. Don't entertain the past. We tend to regret. We tend to worry about what happened. We tend to savor things that went well. He said, don't do that. Just let that go. He says, let that go and be present right here in this moment. And rest. Do not change anything. It's perfect as it is. Let it be, as the Beatles said. And simply be present. That's it. Simply be present. Because your own Buddha nature, your own enlightened mind is present right here. Everything else is just a layer of distraction. And the most important thing is for you to realize that or recognize it for yourself. Because that is what actually will cut off suffering at its root. There are a lot of valuable modalities in psychology, for sure. And I use them and like them and all of that. But, you know, a lot of that is just trimming branches on the tree. They grow back, as we all know, working with our habits and so on and so forth. Requires constant pruning and caring. But this path, if you pursue it, this path of Tilopa brings you to a place where you cut off the root of suffering. We cut it off at the root. Nothing can grow back again. All that's left is wisdom and enlightened mind. So that's the goal. And that's the goal that he established for himself and has passed on to all of us. So there's this other guy. Tilopa's doing that. And he ends up, after that, getting too famous there. And he realizes his tendency for ego trips about being great were too much. And he moves on and actually lives outside of a monastery by a river, far in the trackless wilderness of Bengal in the east of India. And he just lives by the river. He is known as a fishmonger. He would catch and kill fish and take them to market. So all the monks looked down on him. He just had this karma where he had to keep being almost like an untouchable caste. And he was happy with that. He was fine with that, totally unencumbered. So he had this, keep that in mind. So he has this guy named Naropa is born. Also to a pretty well-to-do family. And this guy, you know, there are certain babies that are born, they just kind of glow. They're just, those babies, they show up, pictures of them doing amazing things. Even the way they crawl or coo is amazing. They show up on Facebook nowadays all the time. He was one of those. Just way more adorable than I ever was, you know. Total joie de vie, as my mother would say. So his parents saw what a jewel he was, and they decided early on that this is a jewel that shouldn't get sullied by the dirty old world. And they sent him to the monastery as soon as he came of age. And he became a great scholar. There's a lot of details in the story, ins and outs. But he goes to this monastery and he really picks up on the teachings, really understands them. And he becomes so renowned. There, back then, you know, there's no TV and stuff to entertain people. So they'd have like religious debates. This was the entertainment of the day. And it was like a winner-take-all thing. So a great teacher would have a debate with another great teacher. And the deal was teachers were supported by their students, right? Students would come in and make donations, and the teachers would keep doing what they would do. Well, it was a winner-take-all kind of contest. So if you lost the debate, all your students had to go to the other guy. So this was serious business, right? Well, Naropa was winning debates and getting some renown and some followers. And he then was invited to Nalanda. Nalanda is arguably the greatest university in the history of mankind. It no longer exists, but it was in northern India. And I've heard estimates of how many students were there at any given time, but it was like bigger than Ohio State, which is it or Texas is always the biggest university of the world, depending what year you're looking at. It was bigger than that, and they had just extraordinary teachers there. And he rose through the ranks pretty quickly. And the abbot made him, he had an open slot at the northern gate. The greatest teachers would sit at the four gates of Nalanda and talk to people, debate with people, try to get more, you know, more followers who could support the university and all that. And he became the main guy at the northern gate. And when he was, and he eventually also became abbot. But at one point in his career, he was sitting there just reading, studying, bucolic plays, trees, nice air, reading a book, learning some stuff, being Naropa, it's all good. And, oh yeah, he had a different name at that time too. We'll talk about how he got his name. But, and this dark shadow comes into the room. It's like, and he looks up, and it's this really old hag, toothless woman, wrinkled, bent over, like, just like a Shakespearean witch or something like that, if you want to imagine her. And she cackles at him, and he says, oh, hi, because he's already been trained in compassion, you know, it's like, but he sees her as this old hag, and oh, hi. And she says, can I ask you a question? And he says, sure. And she says, what are you doing? He says, I'm reading the teachings of the Buddha. And she said, well, do you understand them? And he says, as a matter of fact, I do. I understand them very well. And she broke into a dance which was pretty cool because story says she was on a cane and stuff. So she was dancing around and giggling and laughing and just happy to hear that he understood the Dharma. And then she said, I have another question. He said, what is that? Do you understand the essence meaning of the teachings, the ultimate meaning? And he thought to himself, being trained in compassion, by saying yes last time, she became totally joyful, and she's obviously in need of happiness because she's suffering. So he said, yes. And she broke down and wept. And he said, why are you weeping? And she said, for somebody who understands as much as you to still be able to lie is a great tragedy. And he said, without missing a beat, I'm sorry. I want to understand the ultimate meaning. Who can teach that to me? She said, my brother. Who's your brother? She said, Talopa. And literally, this is what the story is. He says, where can I find him? She said, he could be anywhere. But if you follow your heart and you maintain constant devotion and really yearn for the teachings, you'll be guided. So he talks to the abbot. Abbot doesn't want him to leave, but he says, I got to go. And he goes and he starts walking east. Nalanda was kind of in the west part of India. And he encounters 12 different really scary situations along the way. And ultimately, he was able to see that all those scary situations, like, you know, being attacked by animals and all kinds of stuff, almost drowned once, a couple other things, they were all manifestations of his teacher. They were all like part of his path. Because part of his realization had to be that no matter how horrible he thought what was going to happen happened, he actually emerged from it. He got through it. He learned to just keep going no matter what the obstacles were. And that was an important thing. So there were 12 trials. And he finally gets to this little monastery in the middle of the forest in East Bengal, and he's asking around. He's saying, I'm Naropa from Nalanda. You know, it's like, I'm Professor Dershowitz from Harvard. You know, it's like a big whoop-de-doo. Anyway, and he said, I'm looking for Talopa because I have to receive teachings. And the monks are saying, nobody like that around here. Nobody who knows that stuff. And they said, but, you know, there's an old guy down by the river drying fish to drying fish and taking them to the market selling dried fish, because that was a thing, which, you know, killing things is bad. And being a fisherman was right down there with being a sesame seed pounder. And they said, talk to him. He knows everybody. He might know where this guy is. And Naropa goes down to the river and he sees this guy killing fish, beheading them, and laying their bodies to dry in the sun. He's just totally scandalized by this. But he thinks to himself, could this be Talopa? And without any words, Talopa looks up at him and says, I am. I am. And so Naropa said, can you give me teachings? And he said, I will. And then he said, I'm horrified by what's going on with these fish here. antelope takes one and puts the head back on the body and snaps its fingers, and the fish takes off in the water and swims away. Because what he had been doing was that trick that he did up in the cave, where he was transferring the consciousness of the fish to pure realm before he was going to go sell their bodies. I suppose we can, if we could do that, we could do stuff like that too. Anyway, they met, and Naropa said, I want the teachings. And Talopa said, no, not now. And he starts walking away. And he's just walking. Naropa's following after him, insisting. And the faster that Naropa walks to keep up, the slower it appears Talopa is walking, but he keeps gaining ground. It was hot over there in that jungle, and he was getting thirsty and hungry, trying to chase after this wild man, this little berry of a man. And he lost track of him, but he kept going. And he couldn't understand how he was running as fast as he could, and Talopa seemed to be walking, but he couldn't make any ground. Finally, he sees Talopa sitting on a cliff. And Talopa is sitting on a cliff, and he said, I wondered when you were going to get here. And he gets there, and Naropa said, I still want the teachings. And Talopa says, you don't have the purity to receive the teachings I have to give. Naropa said, what should I do? He said, well, first, you have to be able to do anything I tell you to do, no matter what. This gets a little dicey. So he said, well, what should I do? And Talopa said, jump off the cliff. Naropa, without hesitation, jumps off the cliff. He crashes 100 feet below, breaks every bone, and as Kempo Kartha Rinpoche says, every bone and every joint in his body. Talopa goes down and says, are you in pain? He said, I am in excruciating pain. Talopa touches him, and with his touch, he heals him. No more pain. Naropa is just, as you can imagine, just freaked out. And then he says, can I have the teachings now? All he wants, he just has got this thirst. And he said, nope, you're not pure enough yet. And he takes off his sandal and he whacks him across the face with it. This is a famous scene. And Naropa passes out. And when he wakes back up, it's like an aha moment. And Talopa said, we're inseparable. I've never been separated from you, and never will be separated from you. And now it's time for you to get the teachings that you've come for. And he apologized for leading him through so many painful circumstances. But he said, you proved to yourself that you were able to encounter anything without falling into wrong views, without getting into your doubts and hesitations, just letting them go. And so there's this thing here. Yeah, so this is how Naropa got his name. Na in Tibetan means pain. Ro means killing. It's like, because he said, this pain is killing me. And Pod just makes the word a noun. So that's what, this pain is killing me is the name of the second. They just usually call him Naropa, but Kempo Kartha Rinpoche said that. So I just figured, yeah, that's cool. There's a lot of these kind of trials and tribulations in the stories of a lot of teachers. And Kempo Kartha Rinpoche said that in the case of particularly these two guys, coming from such a high birth and having such a high opinion of themselves, it's like a teacher getting a vessel that's totally encrusted with rust. If you just rub the rust with a soft cloth, it'll never reveal the beauty of that vessel. However, if you take the rust off with something really rough and then continue to polish it and shine it once you've got the bad stuff knocked off, something beautiful can emerge. So with a true teacher, they may be harsh sometimes. It's our job to be able to understand that as something maybe we needed. I want to say as an aside that given what's going on in our culture these days, there are problems because there's a responsibility of the students too to actually know how to discern who an authentic teacher is, because obviously somebody who's just powerful but doesn't have compassion and kindness and enlightened mind could just take advantage of people. So it's up to us too to be discerning and careful and take our time. Yeah, we need teachers, but we also really, really have to be, we have to do our part too. I will say for myself in that regard that I first met Kempo Kartha Rinpoche in the late 90s sometime. And I'd heard all the teachings about you need a teacher. And a lot of people, Jelaine was around back then, were running around, oh, Eric, you should get it. You need a teacher, you know, because that's a thing. You need a teacher. And you need that connection with that special person. But I'd also read, you know, it's up to me to really feel an authentic connection. It's not just, it's not necessarily great karma to be clingy and grabby, since clinging and grabbing is what we're actually, the habit, the very habit that we're trying to undo or make ineffective in ourselves. And it took me, I think it was till 2007 to be convinced that I had that kind of connection with Kempo Kartha Rinpoche. And there were other people I'd had the great good fortune of having interviews with and being around. But there was just a time in 2007 when he visited Columbus where it was like that. And I knew. I said, oh. And his, I mean, I asked him if he would be my teacher. And he basically, I was in tears, blubbering like a baby. And he just basically said, well, what took you so long? Well, what took me so long was my own obscurations. But, you know, at least one of those obscurations wasn't grabbing something for my own ego trip about being a Buddhist. And that's the way to see some of these trials and tribulations that these guys go through. It's a matter of living life with an open hand. I had this great analogy that I want to leave you with for what the path is like. So imagine you're sitting in a dark room. All the windows and doors are closed. All the lights are out. All the shades are drawn. And you realize that you want to see something. But you don't know how to turn the lights on. You hear a knock on the door and somebody says, are you okay? And say, I'd like to see something. And they flip the light switch on. That's like somebody teaching you meditation. It turns on the lights. You can see around the room. It's really nice. There are books in there and music and all kinds of good stuff. And eventually you get curious of these shades that are drawn. And so through your own practice, you like pull down a shade and it rolls up and you see outside and you go, wow. And you can see outside, and that glass is so clear and so clean and so pure. It's like you're still inside, but you might as well be outside when you're looking outside. And you're like that for a long time. You really think you can see really well. Then something hits you. That's a hard, it's clear and all that, and you can see right through it, but it's hard. It's a barrier. And you want to get that window open, and you try as hard as you can. 12 years of retreat, you know, is like you're really going for it. I want the window to open. And the window won't open because it's painted shut. You could argue that it's painted shut with your own obscurations and habits and all that stuff we talk about all the time. And somebody comes by and says, can I help you? And you say, I want to get that window open. And they say, well, you can't get it open. It's painted shut. I desperately want it. I desperately want that window open. And so they take off their shoe and they smack the glass and they break it. And all of a sudden, everything you see is the same, because that glass was so clear, but you can feel the breeze and you can feel the air move. And you realize that the air inside your own room and the air outside are one thing. That's the analogy. Came to me this morning while I was meditating. I liked it, so I thought I'd share it with you. Anyway, that's all the time I've got. I believe that I have talked almost to the very end. But if anybody's got questions, comments, concerns, I'd be happy. Question Mike is ready. If anybody's got to leave because I've talked for too long again, feel free. Don't hesitate to do what you need to do. And if there are not any questions, well, I promised one other thing, didn't I? Talopa's called Sesame Seed Grinding Man because he said awakening is just like grinding sesame seeds. That's why he had his awakening grinding sesame seeds. It's like the seeds are very nice and the oil is definitely in them. No doubt about it. Just like we're very nice and Buddha nature is definitely in us. But you have to really work on those seeds to get the oil out. And likewise, for us to realize our own Buddha nature, we have work to do. And so that's the story of Talopa's sesame seed analogy. That's a good one too, obviously. It's lasted for 1,200 years. It must be okay. So let's dedicate the merit of this, particularly to ourselves and to all beings, that we can be able to see the trials we encounter as gifts from our teacher, and that they would be, in fact, that. That no matter what they are or how harsh the circumstances might be, we can get the good of them. We can get the oil out of that seed. So with that in mind, and with people in mind that you know are suffering, please dedicate the merit of this morning's session. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.